Hi again, Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Eva, the Editor-in-Chief. I have a very unique and exciting conversation planned for you today, unique in a few different ways. One is that I have a great opportunity to bring in a friend and colleague who I've greatly enjoyed working with and talking with over the years. His name is Paul Haydad, and he is the Director of Medical Education Research and Co-Director of the Office for Scholarship in Learning and Education Research in the Departments of Medicine, Humanities, and Public Health Sciences at Pennsylvania State University College in Hershey, Pennsylvania. You can probably tell just by virtue of the fact that he comes from Departments of Medicine, Humanities, and Public Health Sciences that he's a unique individual amongst our ranks and has a very broad perspective on many of the issues that we grapple with in the field. Just before I turn the mic, so to speak, over to him, though, let me alert you to the fact that we are going to talk about a paper that he has coming out in the November 2015 issue of Medical Education that's part of the When I Say series that we began publishing about a year and a half ago under the leadership of Kieran Walsh. This is a series that we started in an effort to shed some light on some of the controversial or unclear topics that seem central to health professional education but remain a little bit clouded in terms of how the terms are being used, and trying to offer opportunities for people to clarify and think through what some of these critical concepts might mean. And we went with the title When I Say, out of recognition that there is no individual who could claim absolute truth over any of these things or claim to have the correct answer, but wanted to give people an opportunity to really clarify how they were thinking about the issues in the hopes that it'd help us as a field to better clarify some of these important concepts. Paul's paper is entitled When I Say Patient-Centeredness, and with that as probably an overlong introduction, Paul, let me thank you for making the time to chat with me.
My pleasure.
I know from our past conversations that this is a topic that's near and dear to your heart. Patient-centeredness obviously is one of those things that fits this series very well, because you hear the phrase all the time, both in the clinical world and in the education world. I'll start maybe by just asking you why you thought it warranted this treatment. What is it that's confusing about the term that required some clarification?
Wow, that's a great question. You know, ever since the term patient-centered care was coined in, oh my goodness, I think it was the 70s or the 80s, there really has been a lot of murkiness around what patient-centeredness mean. Does it mean that we are centered only on the patient? Does it mean that we're centered on the relationship with the patient? If we're centered on the patient, does that mean that we're doing what we think is best for the patient? Does it mean that we're doing what the patient thinks is best for the patient? You can see that this can be spun a whole lot of different ways, and it has been spun a whole lot of different ways.
And is there literature that has led people to start to prioritize some ways over another, or given that it's a concept that's been around for as long as you say, has there been any progress towards really centering the term in some meaningful direction?
I think there has, and I think there's been struggles that have been talked about in the literature. One of my favorite papers from the last 10 years or so was a paper that Don Berwick, it was an opinion piece that Don Berwick wrote in Health Affairs called What Patient-Centeredness Should Mean, Confessions of an Extremist. And, you know, it's really interesting. Don was on the Institute of Medicine committee that wrote the Crossing the Quality Chasm part. And for me personally, I remember when that report came out, and, you know, you talk about the six domains of quality, you know, effectiveness and timely and, you know, equitable. And all those definitions in the executive summary, I could, you know, equitable, I read the definition, I'm like, okay, I can see that. And patient-centeredness, that was the one where I always thought, you know, this definition is really murky. I can't really tell what they're saying. And in this piece, Don explains what went on behind the scenes in creating those definitions. And as I understand it, there were two camps on that committee. There was the camp that says patient-centeredness is about us doing what's in the best, the patient's best interests, and we will define that. The medical system will define that. And the other camp was that the patient should define what's in their best interest. And so that language ended up being sort of a compromise language between the two camps. And so it makes sense that it was kind of murky and in the middle. I think one of the great evolutions in the concept was the special issue, which was in Journal of General Internal Medicine in the early to mid-2000s on relationship-centered care, and Mary Catherine Beach's paper in that sort of defining the concept of relationship-centered care, the idea that the focus ought to be the relationship between the patient and the doctor, or the relationship between the patient and the healthcare system, or the relationships between the doctors and the nurses and the team and the patient, that it's about optimizing those relationships. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, really took the patient-centeredness concept to a new level, the idea that if we optimize the relationships, we will optimize health, not only for the patient, but for everybody involved.
And that starts leading us more into the educational realm that Medical Education as a Journal obviously focuses on. What advice do you have for people, given all the reading and research that you've done in this area, with respect to how we might promote patient-centeredness in the way that you're thinking about it?
You know, it's really interesting. I facilitate a group of third-year medical students here at Penn State. We have these groups that meet every 2 weeks, and they're just sort of like debriefing groups for the students on the wards, that they can bring anything back and we can talk about anything and everything. And we were just talking today about the idea of, as medical professionals, we have these extraordinary emotional moments with patients. And is that a bad thing? Is that a good thing? Should we develop that personal relationship? Will that burn us out? And I guess my belief is that, you know, I've studied the hidden curriculum for probably more than 15 years now, and my favorite message of the hidden curriculum is this: if you get too emotionally involved with your patients, you will burn out by the time you're 40. And the reason that's my favorite message is because after practicing for 25 years, I've come to believe that the exact 180-degree opposite is the truth. If you don't get emotionally connected with your patients, you will burn out by the time you're 40.
And can I ask you to elaborate on that a little bit in terms of how you would encourage people to get connected in the way that you're describing? What are the components of a good relationship that's going to, you know, have that preserving effect that you're describing?
Yeah, I think it's a deep human connection. I mean, the components that I talked about in the medical education piece are, I'm going to come to the first one last because I think it's kind of foundational, perhaps the most revolutionary one. The two other components are this. One is the idea of power and responsibility, that this is a relationship that traditionally is very power differential, all the power with the doctor. And if you believe that the only expertise that is worth anything is the biomedical expertise, then of course the owner of all that expertise is the doctor. Although more and more patients are getting on the internet and becoming more and more savvy about their own illnesses, but traditionally the biomedical expertise rests with the doctor. The expertise that rests with the patient is what is going on in their own body, what this feels like, what my body does, whether I tend to run hot or run cold, what my history is. The patient really is bringing some deep expertise to the decision-making process. And the idea that a good decision-making process brings in both sets of expertise, the biomedical and the expertise of one's own body. And if that is the case, then both share power in the decisions, and both share responsibility for the physicians. It's not just the doctor giving a laundry list to the patient. The doctor can say, this is what I think ought to happen. And the patient can say, well, here's what I think. And the two of them come to a decision that at the end of the day might not be exactly what one or the other did. But if they both say, you know, this is the plan and I'm good with it, then I would call that a shared decision. So the idea of power and responsibility. The other one is the idea of treating patients as people, as human beings. You know, the idea that it's not my patient, it's Joe, who I'm helping out with his hypertension. That's a huge, what seems like a subtle shift is a huge shift, because now the patient is a person. I mean, there's a new term in medicine now called person-centered medicine, which I think is an attempt to bring back the idea that patients are not these sort of roles without a person behind it, that they're persons first and illness is second. And so those are two. The third thing that I talk about in the idea in the article is this Carl Rogers, this Rogerian idea of unconditional positive regard, which I see for us practitioners is almost like a stance that we go into the relationship with. The idea that I am going to try to hold the patient in a positive light, even with patients who I'm having difficulty doing that with. Patients that push our buttons as doctors, you know, patients who are suffering from drug addiction and who are very needy tend to, in general, push doctors' buttons. And then, you know, I've got my own hot buttons. Every doctor has their own hot buttons. And inevitably, we're going to meet patients who push those buttons. Those are the times when it is most important to try to find some area that I can connect with that patient. Because if I can't find that, I'm losing the opportunity to sort of deal with my own biases as a medical practitioner. I think that the unconditional positive regard is the wellspring from which motivation to get over biases in healthcare and get over the hidden curriculum and get over the stressors of the job. I think that motivation comes from unconditional positive regard.
The obvious question in follow-up to that is the how do we do that question? How do we get students to the point of being able to take on those three components and practice really in a relationship-centered way? I want to ask it in a slightly different way, though, and I'm going to ask you to push you a little bit beyond the focus of this particular paper, in that in recent years there's been a lot of talk about using these same models in the educational context and thinking about the relationship between educator and trainee. And many of the same issues come up leading towards the educational outcomes that we want. There are likely important differences in the ethics of education as opposed to care, as Claudia Rutenberg and a couple others have argued. And so I'm wondering, in your mind, what you would advise as educators to think about when we're trying to enact relationship-centered practice with trainees?
You know, boy, what a great question. I've been thinking about this a fair amount recently, and I've been exploring among jazz musicians. I've been talking with a number of jazz musicians about what do you do? How do you do that on the bandstand? How do you make that sound harmonious? And, you know, I've really only gotten one answer from every jazz musician I've talked to. And what they say is, you got to listen. You got to be listening your butt off on the bandstand. The music is not going to be good if you are not hearing the meaning that the other players are saying, taking that meaning in and using it as part of what you're saying. If you can't synchronize your meanings, you can't have a conversation that sounds any good on the bandstand. And, you know, I think that holds sway for us educators as well. And I would add to it the attitude that you have to value the other person's perspective. Now, you know, neither of these is new, the idea of the skill of listening or the attitude of valuing another's perspective. What's new for me personally is, in my mind, I have always had those two separated. When I teach communication skills. So as I teach communication skills, I've always had those two separated. Now I'm teaching skills. Now I'm doing reflective writing or reading poetry or something to sort of win attitudes. And I've come to believe in my discussions with the jazz musicians that these two are intimately interconnected and can't be separated away from one another. You can't hear another person's meaning if you don't value what they have to say. And you can't value what the other person says if you can't hear their meaning. The two need to be learned together. And as educators, we need to foster in ourselves the idea that our students have important things to say to us, and we need to be listening deeply. The students in my group today just had a discussion about how one of the students was talking about going on to award service, and the attending came up and said, "Oh, tell me about yourself," and like really wanted to know things other than the superficial about the student and how good they felt. And then they went into the first room with the patient around, and the attending introduced all the members of the team to the patient, but introduced them by their name instead of saying, "This is the medical student," and how much a part of the team they felt. This is what we have to do as educators. We have to make the same kind of connections with our students that patient-centered care is asking us to make with patients.
I think that's a great note to wrap up on. There's obviously a lot more we could and I would love to talk about, but we try to keep these relatively short so that they don't take up an entire hard drive when people try to download and listen to them. But
break your hard drive.
No, exactly. One of my favorite lines from the literature in its entirety, it came from one of your papers. I won't be able to quote it properly, but I remember you writing in one discussion section that after completing this study, we came to appreciate that the issue is much more complex than we originally thought it was. You've done a wonderful job of recognizing and grappling with that complexity while still providing some very clear guidance over the course of your career and with this paper. So thank you for that, and thank you for taking the time to chat, as I said off the top.
Thank you very much.
I will just finish then by reminding our listeners that I've been speaking with Paul Haydet about a paper that he has coming out in the November 2015 issue of Medical Education called "When I Say Patient-Centeredness." Thanks for listening, and we'll be back again next month.